Monster Man, bonus episode, December 2022. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a bonus episode, going out to my patrons at all Patreon levels to say thank you for your continued support. If you've listened to one of these episodes before, you'll know that bonus episodes are where I round up what I've been doing during the month, take a look at what's coming up, talk about movies I've watched, books I've read, etc. And of course, over the last month, it's been the holidays. Happy New Year, everybody. And that means that I have a little more time than usual to spend reading or watching movies, but because people are traveling or have other plans, maybe a little less time gaming than usual, but we'll see how it all shakes out. So first up, I caught up on some of my holiday reading. I'm still in the process of reading the classic Chinese novel, The Romance of the Three Kingdoms. I am going through this very slowly because I'm reading it in parallel with listening to the podcast. The podcast is pretty much just a straight retelling, so it's quite interesting to see what the two adapters, because these are both like translations and necessarily kind of abridgments, what the two adapters have chosen to see as relevant or left out. But I also read a lot of stuff I bought at Dragon Meet. So for example, I read Gangs of Titan City, an RPG, which is maybe unfair of me to call Blades in the Dark Ramunda, but that's kind of what it is. Like, it's a game where you play collectively a gang in a gang-infested, futuristic, dystopian hive city. I bought the particular edition I bought because I happened to like the cover, but I actually did like the game. I think it's something I could play. It's also something that I think would be a good resource if you were running that kind of game, even if you weren't using that system, just because there's a lot of kind of fun inspiration in terms of the different parts of the setting and the different kind of things that might happen in it. Another gaming thing that I read was Cults of Cthulhu from Chaosium. That is by Chris Lackey. Full disclosure, Chris and I game together. I'm playing in a game that he runs, so maybe I'm biased, but I think it's pretty good. I have always thought that cults and their sort of organization and psychology and so on were kind of an underexplored thing in Call of Cthulhu, because you're really more likely to run into people who are devoted to the Cthulhu mythos, devoted to one of its various gods, than you are the monsters. And so the question becomes, why would they do that? And I think that there's a good variety of different explanations. Like, there are three scenarios, each of which involves a different cult. They're all kind of loosely connected, but each of those cults has sort of its own motivation, whether that's like a philosophical principle or a desire to dominate or destroy the world, or a short-sighted desire for wealth, power, and influence. And indeed, one of the scenarios even has a conflict between people who want to use sort of the Cthulhu cult for their own ends and people who want to, like, you know, destroy and terrorize. Okay, non-gaming reading. I read a book called Underground England by Stephen Smith. It had the feel of a series of articles, kind of loosely connected by a theme. I wasn't super impressed with it, to be honest. There were some good bits. It had a good bit about Silbury Hill. It had a good bit about what are often thought to be like secret passages in sort of like Georgian and Regency buildings, or are typically just sort of like servants or service passages. A lot of what are thought of as secret areas in buildings are actually not secret at all. They're just backstage. I thought that bit was fun, but a lot of the rest of it was just kind of like, here's my caving trip. It does have a chapter in which he fails to go into a cave, although he does get to go there at the end of the book, but so it was, you know, it was whatever. The idea that there is a lot of stuff going on underground is exciting because of the subterranean metaphor by which we identify undergroundness with secrecy and death and the unconscious mind and whatever, but the actual realities of why people would put those things in there are also interesting. In practice, I don't know that this was the exploration of that landscape that I wanted. It didn't tell me that much that I didn't already know. It did have some good insights, and it did cost 50p, so I don't regret reading it. As always, I got some history books for Christmas. I read Janina Ramirez's book, Femina, which is about kind of writing the history of the Middle Ages by looking at women, not like women's history, but just using these women as like a lens to look at the intellectual history of the Middle Ages. I, like a lot of people who are primarily high medievalists, I don't find Ramirez's writing about the early Middle Ages very convincing. Now, I don't know whether this is like, oh, this is the bit that you know about, and therefore all the like oversimplifications in a mass market history book feel glaring to you, but also there are just, yeah, I don't know. I believe that Jenny Ramirez is mainly an art historian, or like certainly like a historian. And I did say at one point, you know, historians engage with material culture critically, challenge difficulty, impossible. It's just so weird to hear people talking about how like grave goods reflect who a person was in life in the year 2022, which is just not a thing that archaeologists believe. No, you know, the idea that like the dead don't bury themselves has been a truism for 30, 40 years. Like these are not weird or radical ideas. And it's just interesting to see not only that they haven't been fully accepted by the general public, but that they haven't even been accepted by our colleagues in other disciplines sometimes. But then the later parts of it, I thought were really good. So I don't know if that's just because we were going into the author's main area of expertise, or it's just an area that I know less about, and therefore stuff that might have been obvious to a specialist in the High Middle Ages was not obvious to me. So one chapter that I thought was really interesting was talking about Hildegard von Bingen, right? Now, Hildegard von Bingen is often held up as this unique genius. And without trying to take any of that away, Ramirez does a lot to kind of put Hildegard within a broader social context where these kinds of non-mystics existed in Germany at the time. She's definitely the most prominent, but she's not the only one. And I thought that that was interesting. I know very little about that kind of later church intellectual history, so I thought that was fascinating. But there were just little bits that to me feel like not really true. So for instance, to not, again, not in the high medieval stuff, but in the early Middle Ages, she talks about discussing Æthelflæd and, you know, here's how we're gonna like put her back in the history, and she's often overlooked in favor of Edward the Elder. To which one can only say, no, she is not. No, she's not. Like, Æthelflæd has to be the second or third most famous person from late 9th, early 10th century England. Like, after her dad, and then, I don't know, like, pick a Viking, Ivar the Boneless. She is a main character on a very popular TV show that just ended. Like, I think she's really well known. Indeed, I think it's very characteristic to see her cast as a protagonist and Edward the Elder as a villain. And I don't think all that many people, like, I think if you were a medieval historian, probably Edward the Elder stands out to you as very important because he's, you know, the king. But in terms of the popular consciousness of the early Middle Ages, I don't think there are a lot of Edward the Elder stands out there. But people are ride or die for Æthelflæd. I have at least one miniature of Æthelflæd, and I know that there are at least three available, and it would surprise me to find that there was even one of Edward the Elder. I think Æthelflæd is pretty well known. I have read novels by multiple authors in which she's an important character. So I think that that's a comment on like the public perception of the early Middle Ages in an earlier era. You know, like when I was a kid, and by extension, I presume when the author was a kid, all of this was true. You know, Æthelflæd was a little known figure, but that hasn't been true for a while now. Those are nitpicks. Like I enjoyed the book and thought it was good, but there were some bits where I felt that I wasn't hearing anything new from the early medieval stuff, but that may be different for different readers. Speaking of which, the next book I read was Judith Green's book, The Normans, which is a kind of comparative study of the different areas of Norman activity in the 11th and 12th centuries, and is very focused on like modern writers and to some extent medieval writers, although I think Green would argue maybe not to the extent you think, had this sense of the Normans as being like a special people. And Green is kind of trying to look at, you know, are there patterns that we can consistently observe across England and southern Italy and Sicily and Antioch, full of little tidbits about the Norman world in a way that I thought was gameable. Otherwise, more of a straight historical argument, and a really interesting example of how something that I think is not written for a general audience, it's very rich, but even to me, who, like, this is an area that I feel like I know a good deal about, but even to me, it felt organized in a way that was not very accessible. It felt like much more work. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but that's how I felt reading it. Film. I watched Glass Onion, which I think is the movie everybody watched on December 23rd or 24th. I didn't enjoy it as much as the first one, but I still thought it was very good. I thought the performances in general were good. I hope this means the return of the star-studded whodunit. I've speculated about this in previous episodes. You know, I think I talked about this when I watched those Branagh, Agatha Christie movies, which I didn't think were very good, but it was kind of still nice to see it. I like a superhero movie as much as the next guy. Indeed, considering the important role that superheroes play in my, like, childhood or whatever, I may conceivably like a superhero movie more than the next guy, although the next guy does appear to like superhero movies a pretty good amount. But if we're going to see, like, prestige actor does turn as murderer or victim in a whodunit, rather than does turn as what a comic book villain would be like, filtered through some misguided idea of seriousness or realism, then I think that's great. I watched the holiday musical Spirited, which I thought was okay. You know, it's an adaptation of A Christmas Carol. Writing successful musicals is really hard. Like, you're watching all these songs and dance numbers and being like, these songs are fine, but I can already sort of feel that I'm not going to remember any of them. I don't really remember the melodies of any of them. I don't really remember the lyrics. It just, like, they're not bad, but there's just, I don't know, writing a Broadway smash seems like it's really difficult, which I guess is why there are so many jukebox musicals, which is bad. I mean, I'd rather see something like this, but I don't think it was bad. I gotta say, you know, I do not generally like Will Ferrell. I would say that I have an overall negative view of him. But then when I think about all the films of his that I've watched, there's a lot of really good ones. And he's willing to take a big swing. Casa de mi Padre is a weird movie. It's weird that he made it. And I have to applaud that. I watched The New Mutants, which was a mess. I am not, like, the biggest X-Men fan in the world, but I do have some fond memories of The New Mutants of that era. And then also, I think some of Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men's love of the classic New Mutants has rubbed off on me a little bit. But it wasn't even that movie just replaced some of the characters, particularly Roberta, with sort of teen movie stock characters. It was that I don't think the film had any real sense of what it was about, like what it was supposed to be. My understanding is that this may be a too many cooks in the kitchen scenario, with all the weird stuff that was going on at Fox around the time this movie was getting made. Anyway, it was bad, unfortunately, because I am fond of some of those characters. You know, like, if you know me, I think you could predict who my favorite New Mutant is. And that's a shame, because I think those are fun characters, and I think there's a good movie to make from them, but that was not it. I watched Prometheus, because it's on Disney Plus, and I sort of felt this weird. I played in an alien RPG for a couple sessions, and it rekindled my interest in the franchise a little bit, and I did feel a little bit like there are 8 Alien movies, and I've watched 6 of them, so, you know, why not just watch the other 2? The reason for why not is that Prometheus isn't very good, and it's interesting because it's challenging, I think, to put your finger on where exactly is the flaw that makes it so unsatisfying. Like, all the performances are good. I mean, if you said, this is a movie about space explorers and Dare, Michael Fassbender, Idris Elba, Rooney Mara, and Charlize Theron, you'd be like, okay, you know, I'll check this out. And Benedict Wong, like, before he was a big deal. It's fine, I guess, in that sense. But I think ultimately it's attached to these sort of abstract questions that don't really move people. It's got all this stuff about, like, where do we come from? What is our purpose? But doesn't really try to answer them in a meaningful way, but it also doesn't lean into the answer being there is no answer. This is a cosmic joke. It's just like, it's like At the Mountains of Madness. I mean, it's very much like At the Mountains of Madness. But if At the Mountains of Madness had no guts, because it's sort of, it feels like it avoids engaging emotionally with any of those questions, like explaining why people would care about them other than some stuff about dads. I mean, Hollywood and daddy issues, you know. But then also, it just has a bunch of, like, action movie rigmarole every now and again, right? Like, they just kind of felt like, oh, well, we need a spectacular action scene. And maybe that stuff landed better in the cinema. Disappointing. Well, not disappointing because I expected it to be bad. I saw Barbarian, which I thought was not perfect but effective. I don't really like horror movies as a rule, but I thought there were a lot of good, well-observed bits in this one. I thought the way it's kind of broken up very sharply into acts worked okay. Could have been distracting, but in the end I thought it was all right. There were things that I felt didn't completely work, but its bits were very effective, and that's horror movies for you. So I was pleased. So here's a mild spoiler for Barbarian. You might want to skip ahead about 20 seconds if you care about this stuff, but Bill Skarsgård is not the monster, and you're kind of meant to think he is because he's Bill Skarsgård, and it's not a connection I made as I was watching it, even though I did recognize him. I think I had to look him up on IMDb to realize who it was I was looking at, but I thought it was good. And finally, speaking of monster movies, which I tend to like much more than horror movies, if you see what I mean, I watched Troll, the kind of Norwegian kaiju movie. I thought it was good. It's not perfect, again. You know, I thought, like, this is going to be a Norwegian twist on the kaiju formula, but it's almost not really a twist. It's kind of the formula. It's got some silly bits. I think it tonally, it struggles a little bit to balance kaiju disasterness and a sort of sense of, like, mournfulness rooted in, you know, pervasive environmental concerns and whimsy. That's a mixture that doesn't always quite work out. Gaming-wise, as some games slowed down over the holidays, I did get to run a session or two of my normal D&D game. I'm welcoming a new player in the coming year, which is going to be a lot of fun. And I'm doing things like working on that character's miniature and, you know, looking for ways to integrate this new character into the existing player character group. This is always a little tricky. I do think it's something that's maybe trickier in my head than it is in reality, because the players have an out-of-character goal of bringing this new character in and making them feel welcome. So there is kind of, you know, sometimes you'd be like, oh, I don't know if this explanation for why they're all together is plausible, but the reality is that the players will just probably ride over it. So it may be something that bothers only me, and it doesn't even bother me all that much, but it's something I've been thinking about. I want to make sure that there's a compelling reason for the characters to be together, especially in a context where there is, like, sort of a hierarchy, like one of the characters does work for one of the others. There is a character who is pretty clearly the at least nominal leader. Although, you know, again, that's one of those problems that hasn't really come up in play because, in fact, the characters cooperate and get on. I played some miniatures games. I played a game that a friend of mine is playtesting, which was interesting. Has no dice, has no rulers. This seems to be a trend that's been going on for a while in miniatures game design, but it's never really had its kind of classic exponent. I know that one of the Mantic games is rulerless, like it's based on a grid, and then I believe Age of Penda is based on a grid as well, and another game from the same designer, Blam Blam Arg, is based on a grid. This is not a grid-based game. It's more like fixed movement lengths like Song of Blades and Heroes. So I guess it really does have rulers. It just doesn't have rulers, if you see what I mean. But no dice. It's very interesting. It reminded me a little bit of playing a game like the Banner Saga. There's a similar thing in Gubat Banwa. And Gubat Banwa explicitly cites tactics video games like Final Fantasy Tactics or whatever as an influence. So I wonder if that's a part of it. I also played some Call of Cthulhu, which was fun. I have my reservations about Call of Cthulhu. That game used to be so important to me, and I think I had this big Call of Cthulhu project, and I think I just burned out on it a little bit, you know? I think I just kind of overloaded the Call of Cthulhu section of my brain, and even though I try to keep up with it, I don't know that I feel the same excitement about it that I used to. But I had a really nice time playing this game, and I think I do have to remember that I enjoy playing the game, and maybe I just need to detach the player and the, like, keeper slash writer sides of my mind. And I'm working on some miniatures projects, which I won't go into too much because this is an audio medium, but I'm very excited about them. Oh, I've also started doing hashtag Dungeon 23. I haven't really got to the dungeon itself yet. It is only day 2 as I record this, but I'm doing a thing that is relevant to the campaign I'm currently running. So this may be the kind of final boss dungeon for my campaign. which might come up in a, you know, about a year. So maybe I'll spend 2023 writing this dungeon, and then 2024 my players will descend into it to confront a great evil. Maybe that won't happen at all, but I'm having fun working on it anyway. We got some exciting special episodes coming up, and I am also preparing to record some episodes of other podcasts. So you can look for me on the podcasts of some friends of the show. So stand by for announcements about those. And I'm also preparing to teach a class about games and history. It's just sort of one lecture and one participatory demo thing, but that ought to be fun. I have never really done very much gaming in a classroom environment before. I did do a little kind of roughly improvised game with my history students during the medieval section, but generally no. So I'm looking forward to that too. So there's a lot of good stuff coming up in the next few months, and I hope that you will be with me for it right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram at MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.